Coming up today, Sudanese volunteers have developed a 3D printed prosthetic limb that costs just £60. A study explores why we cheat at video games, and digital rights activists are not happy about NSA surveillance and are fighting back. We'll also be talking about emperor penguins, rhinos, and so-called lifestyle cryptocurrencies such as Kanye West. All that and more coming up. This is the wire.co.uk podcast, your weekly guide to the important and the interesting, from science and tech to rhino poaching prevention and cryptocurrencies. I'm your host, Olivia Solon, and I'm the deputy editor of wire.co.uk.
I'm Liak Clark.
And I'm Katie Collins.
I just realised I didn't say Olivia underscore Solon.
I know, I noticed that. It's because new. It's not in your notes.
It feels weird. Yeah, I need to have that underscore written in my notes. It's kind of a weird sort of impulse thing. Anyway, this is the second week without Nate. He's still West Coast US, having trawled the floors of CES until his little hooves ground down. Mm. I think he got about 25 stories in total, so he's now having a little rest in San Francisco. Just before we came on today, I was trying to, I had a little hesitation in my intro because I was trying to work out how to pronounce the cryptocurrency spelt D-O-G-E-C-O-I-N. And how basically the first part of that word, we know how to spell, how to say coin. And I asked if there was a consensus on Twitter about it. And clearly there isn't, because we've got Dogecoin, 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 which was my the way I'd been saying it in my head. How are you guys thinking
See,
about it?
I don't know why, but I had always said it as Dogecoin, but I don't think that's correct.
You see, I always said it in my head as Dogecoin, but I think I thought that that was wrong, and that I thought that really it should be Dogecoin, but I had this like overwhelming instinct to call it Dogecoin.
I think because Doge is actually a word, whereas doggy it's not something we're used to reading.
Right, well, if you have a view on this or you know what the answer is, please do email us on podcast@wire.co.uk, because it's embarrassing for everybody involved. Anyway, let's get on with the news. Liat, there have been some innovations in 3D printing in Sudan involving limbs.
Yes, indeed. They are 3D printing limbs for around $100, which is £60, in just 6 hours. This all began really because of a story about a young man called Daniel Omar, who at 14 years old did an interview with Time magazine. Now, he was living in the Nuba Mountains, which is an area in Sudan where a lot of conflict has been ongoing between government and rebels. And he did an interview talking about how he'd lost both his hands in a bomb drop by government forces. And basically he said if he could have died, he would have, because he felt like he was a burden on his family and he wasn't able to kind of work in the way he used to. Now, a guy called Mike Ebeling, who is the founder of Not Impossible, a California nonprofit, read this story and immediately thought, you know, there has to be something we can do.
That's not impossible.
That's not impossible. Exactly. So he got together a really great group of people, a guy called Richard Van Ass, who developed the Robo Hand, which is this cool prosthetic, which is now open source. He developed this when he lost 4 fingers on one of his hands. He got together Printerbot, a guy called Brooke Drum from Printerbot, which is again an open source 3D printer, and a guy called David Petrino, a physiotherapist who's also happens to have a PhD in the neuroscience of motor control. And he said, guys, let's 3D print this lovely young man some artificial limbs. And that is exactly what they did.
And it's not just about 3D printing artificial limbs. It's about doing it at this incredibly low cost. Because I wrote earlier, I think end of last year, actually, about a project in the UK called the Open Hand Project, where a guy in Bristol had managed to print a hand that was, you know, it was a myoelectronic, I think is the word, where it connects with your nerves.
Myoelectric.
And he developed it for £600, and that was seen as being incredibly cheap, and he wanted to make it cheaper. But £60, $100 is incredible.
Yeah, I mean, it's not on a scale with those types of prostheses like the myoelectric ones. It's a mechanical hand, so there is lots of movement, and there's like a really lovely video online on the Not Impossible's website of this young guy, Daniel Omar, using it to feed himself for the first time. And it gives you some amount of dexterity. But, you know, it's all the kind of big corporations. We write about them a lot that do these myoelectric prostheses, which involves an operation, you know.
And they cost tens, if not hundreds of thousands of pounds or dollars.
Exactly. And, you know, it's also depends on if you've managed to salvage the nerves at the time of the incident, which obviously is probably not something that was a priority when this happened. So they went out there, they got the doctor who had actually done the amputation to help out, an American guy, and, you know, brought their 3D printers, laptops, loads of plastic along, and print it within the first few days and had him trying it out and kind of adapting it to him. But the cool thing is about it is they have left all the equipment there, and they've trained locals living in Daniel's village how to use it. And I think they printed four new arms within the space of a week and a half after they left.
Mm-hmm. But what's happening now?
Well, they've had a big push with this project that they want to take it global, and they're kind of hoping that this story will be picked up, which it has been obviously in the press a great deal, and they want to take it global and have this going on in countries all over the world. This is specifically targeting somewhere where there's not a lot of funds for things like this, and war-torn regions where people would really benefit from it. But, you know, it was a really cool example with the robo hand, the guy who helped make the mechanical element of this prosthesis. His is open source, and he's been taking it around and building kids' hands. And there's these tear-jerking videos online of young girls and boys using their hands for the first time, and they're amazing. But his was actually used by a bunch of school kids in Michigan to build a four-year-old a hand. So it's kind of, that's the example of it being taken on by, you know, probably kids that didn't know a great deal in the first place about melting plastic.
Yeah, it's a gift that keeps on giving.
Yeah.
Katie, why do people cheat in video games?
So we think we have a better idea of why this occurs. There's been a study that's been done, particularly focusing on online gaming. And the study's been done among teenagers in Singapore, and it's revealed that the reason that people tend to cheat in online games is because they presume that everyone else is also cheating. So the study showed that people's behaviour is quite significantly influenced by how they sort of view the behaviour of the people around them, and, you know, kind of the community within which they're sort of interacting with people, what they sort of observe, I guess, are the rules of engagement.
And the rules are there are no rules.
Exactly.
Well, the rules are that guy's doing too well. He's obviously cheating.
Yeah. There doesn't even really need to be sort of evidence, but like it's more the kind of
I don't know them, so they must be cheating.
General perception. Yeah. And in fact, it's really sort of shown that that this is much more likely to happen when people are playing games with strangers rather than with friends. So it's the kind of when they're playing in an anonymous group.
Yeah.
And that's not because they suddenly feel like, you know, they don't need to be self-conscious about cheating anymore or anything like that. It's because they sort of, I guess they change their perception of what's going on.
Oh wow!
So it's not at all due to being less self-conscious. So also that it's quite difficult to define cheating. So as part of the study, they defined cheating as strategies that a player uses to gain an unfair advantage over his/her peer players, or to achieve a target which is not supposed to be achieved according to the game rules or at the discretion of the game operator. This was observed during gameplay between sort of anonymous teenagers, but also in a follow-up focus group, the participants kind of confirmed that this is what they were thinking when they were sort of playing. It showed that participants viewed cheating as something that everyone's doing, and if they don't do it, they will then lose out because of it. The study does have some limitations in that it's kind of difficult to judge different genres, and, you know, doesn't kind of take those things into account, or whether people cheat differently when they're playing different games. But it's quite interesting to see that if we could perhaps alter what we consider to be normal behaviour within an online community,
yeah,
that it might be able to, you know, sort of counter the negative behavior that we see. And that's not just in gaming, where you might experience cheating, but also in other online communities.
Like comments and stuff.
Exactly, yeah.
I guess it must tie in some way, or at least it feels like it does, to the online disinhibition effect, whereby, you know, people are more outspoken and more unpleasant online in a way that they would never be to people's faces. And there's this general, especially when, you know, when you've got anonymity involved, there's this general feeling of kind of, well, you don't know that person, so you don't care about them so much, or you know don't think about them as being having feelings. And the way you talked about having, you know, when you didn't know who the other players were versus your friends playing, I think that suggests that there might be a kind of link there.
It's more like, so they will sort of, it's how they sort of perceive other people behaving around them. And if they see people, or if they just think that people are sort of thinking in a similar way to them, and that certain behaviours are sort of acceptable, they will then exhibit those behaviours themselves, even if they don't necessarily have any proof that other people are doing it.
Oh, but we have an innate distrust in other people, or it's easier to see the bad in other people that we see in ourselves when they're not our friends.
And it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, you know, like now everyone actually is cheating. So why do you cheat? If you do cheat, maybe you are all very honest gamers, but if you do cheat, let us know why. podcast@wired.co.uk. Now, in January 2011, Aaron Schwartz was arrested for downloading a huge number of files from journals from the JSTOR database to a laptop at MIT. And a year later, he took his own life, and he was only 26 years old. Since then, Edward Snowden's revealed the enormous scale of the state surveillance that the US and other governments have carried out. And now a load of digital rights and media organisations are launching a day of protest against mass surveillance. And it's called The Day We Fight Back. And it's going to take place on the 11th of February. Now, the kind of people who've signed up to this include the Electronic Frontier Foundation, Demand Progress, which is actually an organisation that Aaron set up with a friend of his, Reddit, Boing Boing, and even Mozilla have all signed up to kind of take action on this day.
What are they encouraging people to do?
They're saying protest however you see fit. So what we might end up seeing are things like blackouts, as we saw in the SOPA and PIPA protests. And, you know, we had organisations like Wikipedia having blackouts. We might just see people raising funds. We might see people just having, you know, having banners and, you know, these little Twitter twibbons, whatever they're called. I don't know. I think they're just, it's kind of up to people to make their own minds up.
So yeah, I take it the mood is generally more peaceful rather than aggressive in terms of what they're encouraging people to do.
I think they're letting people interpret the protest in their own way. I think there's a particular subreddit on Reddit, the kind of official subreddit called The Day We Fight Back, and Reddit generally is pretty good-humoured, good-natured. I mean, they're quite they're troublemakers without being kind of mean. And so I suspect we'll see some kind of playful things. Already Anonymous have been piling in, the kind of nebulous group that is Anonymous. They took down the MIT website on the anniversary of Aaron's death and made reference to this, The Day We Fight Back. So there may be some distributed denial of service attacks, but again, it's open to however people want to interpret it. I don't think Mozilla is going to be doing anything of the sort. But yes, the founder of Demand Progress, David Segal, who founded it with Aaron, said, "Today, the greatest threat to a free internet and broader free society is the National Security Agency's mass spying regime. If Aaron were alive, he'd be on the front lines fighting back against these practices that undermine our ability to engage with each other as genuinely free human beings." So if you're interested in finding out more about this, there is the subreddit The Day We Fight Back, and, you know, perhaps tell us about how you might think about protesting, if indeed you do want to protest, or if you disagree with the protest.
Yeah, it'd be really interesting to hear what people have got planned, and yeah, let us know.
Yeah, and what should we be doing? Let's talk about penguins. When we think about emperor penguins, the first word that comes to mind probably isn't agile, Katie.
No.
But it seems like they might be more agile than we think.
Yes, indeed. I mean, penguins, all penguins are very, very graceful in the water. But, you know, if you've ever seen kind of that hilarious footage of penguins sort of toddling along on land, then you'll know that they are not particularly graceful when they're out of the water. And also the bigger they are, the more clumsy they are. Well, there's a kind of a new study that's been done on emperor penguins, which are those kind of really the attractive, the big penguins that have got those big, attractive sort of colourful bills. I think they're the kind of penguins that people always sort of picture in their head.
Yeah.
But anyway, there's a study that's been done by the British Antarctic Survey, which has found that these emperor penguins are actually capable of climbing up vast ice shelves in order to breed. Now, it was always thought that emperor penguins required stable sea ice to breed on, and the ice needed to be unbroken from April when they lay their eggs to December when the chicks fledge. But they've recently been spotted climbing onto ice shelves out of the sea with sheer cliffs that are up to 60 meters high.
Wow.
In order to breed when the sea ice conditions have been poor.
So this is some extreme penguin.
It is. So they haven't actually seen them do this, but satellite observations have shown that they've been up on these shelves, that they actually know of 46 emperor penguin colonies altogether, and four of them have been spotted up on these shelves, and they've seen their tracks. They will climb up there in the years where the sea ice hasn't frozen early enough. So it's kind of a reaction to, you know, their normal breeding ground not being ready for them. Mm. They'll kind of take it upon themselves to go elsewhere.
Wow.
I can picture them sliding back down.
Yeah.
I can't picture them getting
up. What's that cartoon where the penguins are actually like the badass ninjas of the animal kingdom?
Oh, Madagascar.
Madagascar.
Yeah.
I like to imagine that this is somehow tied in with that.
Yeah.
Don't worry, we look like we're bumbling when you're looking at us, but when you go away, we are kind of backflipping.
Yeah. I want to see the guys who saw the satellite footage like, oh my God, how did we miss the bit in between?
Yeah, sailing, rock climbing.
They've got no idea how the penguins have climbed up onto these shelves. And they've noticed that sometimes to go up, they will go really, really far out the way so that they can find a less steep way up onto the shelf. So sometimes they'll sort of waddle 5 kilometres out of the way and sort of take a roundabout route. But they're perfectly happy actually to come down.
The steep route.
Yeah. Quite often these are sort of almost sort of sheer cliffs. There is more than just this kind of wow, how are these penguins doing this element to this story, in that emperor penguins are actually considered near threatened. Mm. And it's thought that maybe by 2052 up to half of the emperor penguin population could have died out. Mm. And this is due to the fact that the kind of climate change and the fact that the sea ice is consistently not kind of forming when it should every year. But now that we know that emperor penguins can in fact breed elsewhere when they need to, it's possible that they might have a better chance of surviving than we thought.
Oh.
It's possible that all emperor penguins could do this, and maybe they've done it for years but we just haven't seen it before, so it's not necessarily purely a reaction to climate change.
Right, we're going to take an ad break now, but when we come back we're going to be gazing into the wired crystal ball.
Audible.co.uk is offering every listener of the Wired.co.uk podcast a free audiobook of your choice from a catalogue of over 80,000 titles. To claim yours now, go to audible.co.uk/wired and sign up for your free trial and your free book.
Welcome back. Next up, we are going to be gazing into the wired crystal ball. So this week we had a fantastic kind of thought piece from Carl Miller, who's research director at the Centre for the Analysis of Social Media at the think tank Demos. And he thinks that we are entering into an era where people might have their own currencies depending on their politics or depending on a kind of lifestyle choice. Now, he's talking in the wake of new cryptocurrencies that have emerged, such as the aforementioned Doge, Doggy Coin, delete where appropriate, and things like Kanye West, which has been in legal wranglings with Kanye West. I love that they shifted their brand, their marketing, by saying, this isn't about you, this is about a half fish a koi and half man hybrid. So we're not ripping your identity.
Take that, Kanye.
Take that, Kanye. There was another one with Chuck Norris, and Chuck's also not happy that his
come on, Chuck. Name That's is a being
rebirth. Used. Norris Wait, coin, I think it was.
Should be honoured. I would be really pleased if somebody made a coin about me.
Only if a fraction of every spend went to me.
But yeah, I mean, it's not all about Bitcoin. We talk about Bitcoin a lot, but Carl just talks about lots of different types of coins, from world coins and a non-coin, which is more anonymous, stable coin, and they all tend to use the Bitcoin protocol or variations of the Bitcoin protocol. Mm. And a website set up recently where you could actually just create your own cryptocurrency. So I think Alex Hearn at The Guardian created Hearn Coin, and various other people did these sort of gonzo journalism, you know, creating their own currency, the idea could be that as it becomes easier to set up your own currencies, and as perhaps, you know, you feel disassociated from the existing financial system, that people, you might start getting shops that will only accept an eco coin, or I don't know, like I guess you always already have things like the Brixton pound in London and various other little currencies that aim to support local businesses, but this is the same but in a digital context.
But then I guess that maybe the flip side to that is, if there's so many, you think it's so easy to make and everyone's making them all the time, that you will stop trusting them as much. Like, there has to be like a turning point where you trust them because they're so easy to make and everyone's making them.
True.
And it's already great, and then you're like,
and the value isn't stable necessarily. But I like the idea. I like to imagine this future where, I mean, there is apparently already a sex coin.
Yeah, I know. I read this article and he was like, which obviously is used for the obvious purposes. And I was like, what do I use all my sex coins for? Just buying sex? Would a porn? I don't know.
Yeah. If you go to Amsterdam, then you'll know that there are many different kinds of places you can spend
your sex coins.
Potentially.
I bet they don't take sex coins in Amsterdam, do they?
Is it kind of like a posh, you know, gift card? Not posh, but, you know, like, you know, when you get a Topshop voucher, if you've got a sex coin, is that good? Is that
one
bad?
Sex for you?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Or is it a little bit like when you haven't bought a present for your dad when you were little and you'd give him...
Oh, my God.
Like,
why are you giving him a sex coin?
No. And then you'd give him, like, a voucher that would be like, I'll do some chores.
Oh, well,
yes.
I wish you hadn't used the example of...
Your dad.
Oh, sorry.
That's awful. No, but another example would be that you could perhaps give kids pocket money that can only be spent in certain shops. It's like, you know, technologically limited on where you can spend it, which is an interesting idea. Currency, which has always been something that you don't really get to choose which one you use, could suddenly be a sort of way of identifying yourself as part of a particular cultural tribe.
It's the thing that I find most interesting about it is that we usually tie currency very much to sort of national identity.
Yes.
And perhaps that's something that might erode further due to the kind of the introduction. People might start thinking about things differently in terms of kind of how they identify themselves culturally and nationally.
I thought it was interesting that he was talking about, it'll probably be very easy to exchange between these currencies, which like today isn't with normal currencies. Like, it's a real pain.
Yeah.
So if you can swap and change and interchange all the time, depending on what you need that day, your sex coin or your Doge doggy coin.
And that in itself might create an interesting kind of whole economy around speculating on the values of these small currencies.
What do people need more today? Sex
coin or... And there could be business and kind of arbitrage between currencies of some sort. I think I probably need to talk this through with some kind of economist. But will you be having your own currency? Is there a Liv coin, a Liat coin, a Katie coin in the pipeline? Tell us what you think on podcast@wired.co.uk. The second and final segment of today will be WWWTF. What the? Leah, this week you spoke to a conservationist who suggested that auctioning off the right to shoot a rare rhino for $350,000 might is a good idea and makes sense.
I did, yes.
WTF.
I know, I'm sorry. I was quite afraid that people get annoyed. But
I'm annoyed.
Don't be annoyed, guys. Well, you know, you can be annoyed a bit, but there's a reason to why he is saying this. So there was loads of outrage in the press when there's headlines everywhere about this permit being sold in Texas at a safari club, the Dallas Safari Club.
And this is by Namibia, right?
Yeah. So the Namibian government, first of all, should be aware, are the ones who have given them the right to sell this permit. And they actually sell 3 permits every single year for this precise reason, for conservation work. So they will take 100% of the funds and pour it back into conserving the black rhino population.
At a cost of 3 black rhinos.
Yes.
This is rhino coin.
they say, you know, obviously a lot of care goes into this, and the only rhinos they're allowed to kill is, they actually like pick out specific rhinos, and they're aging rhinos that can no longer mate. I don't know, I feel sad for them now because they're just useless to the population. Well, so they kill them off. But no.
That's a little bit better than what I thought it was, because, you know, I was a bit worried that perhaps it might end up being a mother rhino that...
No. I think they would never
that was really
allow that to happen. No. Nothing,
so they section
like
off
that.
The right rhino.
Yeah. You're only allowed to kill this one rhino. So I spoke to this guy, Bob Smith, from the Durrell Institute of Conservation and Ecology. And he's actually working on a conservation project in South Africa right now, specifically for black rhinos. Mm. And he says that South Africa and Namibia have been doing this successfully for years. And he pointed to the white rhino numbers in South Africa going up to 20,000 from just a few dozen. And part of this they put down to private landowners having incentives to actually to work on conservation. And one of these things was trophy hunting. Bit of a downer. I mean, like, no one likes to think that trophy hunting would be a good thing.
But better than poaching, maybe.
Well, exactly. I mean, this is the problem. They had, I think, rhino numbers plummeted during the 90s, around the 80s, 90s, because of poaching. And then there was a real concerted effort to fight back against it. Mm. And obviously, a lot of work has been done. But
if
we
know your rhinos might potentially be worth $350,000 as a trophy once a year, you probably would be able to afford to put in some security to prevent those poachers from coming in and slaughtering your other rhinos.
I don't think it's that straightforward, because they find a way. Like when I went to South Africa last year on honeymoon, and they were saying to me, you know, for a lot of these people, they know that if they are caught on the reserve,
they'll be
shot on sight. And they're risking their lives because they can get so much money for these rhino horns that you know, certain countries in Asia think have amazing medicinal properties. So these people, you know, they're willing to die. They'll be shot on sight, and equally rangers in South Africa are killed just doing their job because they happen to be the wrong place at the wrong time. So I think, you know, people will go to any lengths for this because of the worth. So this guy Bob Smith said, the standard narrative on African rhino conservation drives me mad, as it is overly negative and assumes the people in charge don't know what they're doing. And his point is, Namibia has like an amazing track record on conservation. They've been early adopters of using things like drones and satellite tracking chips in rhinos and all sorts of stuff. And they've been doing this for years and actually have taken quite a savvy move, which is to take it out of the country. Usually these permits are sold every year in Namibia, and this is why it's got so much press, is because it's the first time
they've
gone out. Yeah, and they've gone to like the center of, you know, what we
rich hunters,
like crazy hunters that want to have a you think an elephant head on their wall or something, like Texans,
the people who would never go to Namibia to go to an auction.
Yeah, exactly.
But they would go to shoot.
But they'll go through these operators that go to Namibia to get the permits. But I think the highest selling permit in 2013 was $223,000. So they've managed to raise $100,000 more, but originally I think their estimates were $750,000. So if they'd nailed that, they'd be a massive argument for doing this again. So I mean, you could think, you know, this is still cruel and awful, and this is one conservationist opinion. But I also then spoke to a conservation charity called Save the Rhino, and they were kind of, you know, they weren't outwardly saying this is amazing, but they did actually refer to the auction as an innovation and said, you know, Namibia, again, has a great track record. They've been doing this for years. And they've spotted how they can potentially bring in a lot more money, which is taking it to these safari clubs. So I think it's interesting. I don't know. I mean, they said $500,000 a year to run a small rhino program protecting 20 to 30 animals. Yeah. That's a huge cost. And there's 5,500 black rhinos left, I think. And 1,700 of those are in Namibia.
I guess that's why it seems so ludicrous to be selling them off. But if that means you can breed, you know, 10 more, 20 more, then I guess it is worth it.
Yeah, I mean, they've been doing this for years, so it can't, and the numbers have been rising really quite rapidly. There was this article in the New York Times about how the desert lion population in Namibia peaked so much that actually villagers started to hate them and have revenge attacks because they were killing cattle. So then the Namibian government introduced these kind of wildlife safari programs and also compensated farmers for their loss and tried to kind of... show them that it's a good thing the numbers are rising. Sorry about your cattle.
You said that these techniques have helped increase the population from 2,400 in 1995 to around 5,000 today. So, yes, it's
significant. I mean, there's obviously other measures going into play there, but this is something that these numbers of black rhinos are in South Africa and Namibia, and these are two countries that have been doing this trophy hunting for some time. Obviously, there are people that don't put 100% of the funds back into it. There will be countries or governments where they're not allotting the funds adequately, but I think that these two countries have been a good example for where they have been. But I don't know, even hearing all that, does it sit well with you that they
when I first heard about this, I think I was very sort of heart over head. I was like, no, this is definitely wrong. But actually, the more I think about it, they are struggling so much to come up with proper techniques to conserve rhinos in so many countries. And you know, if the rhino that is being kind of auctioned off, as it were, would probably die fairly soon anyway. And the amount of money that it seems to be raising, it does seem to be quite a positive thing.
And I think there was a good point made in a paper actually that Sky Smith had written before, which is, okay, a country like Namibia only has something like 2.2 million people. It's not going to have huge unending funds to pour into conservation work. And apparently there is a lot of problems with countries where funds for conservation projects are coming from external sources. So say a charity in the UK raises funds and then sends a project there, and it's kind of being controlled through outside parties. Apparently there's a lot of kind of corruption and it doesn't necessarily streamline through to the final project, whereas like Namibia seems really great at making sure everything is kind of in-house, so to speak, and making sure it's kind of coming from their own people.
I suppose there's also the struggle in some countries where if it's a poor country where it might be hard to justify spending government money on conservation animals, programs
instead of people.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, that's probably all we've got time for today, but we'd love to hear your thoughts on the matter, so please do email us on podcast@wired.co.uk. you can also, as ever, tweet us on @wiredUK, and you can visit our Facebook page, facebook.com/wiredUK. And on that note, I'll say goodbye.
Cheerio.
Bye.